Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It is now 20 past 11. And so if I can turn directly to the applicant for responding submissions on the composite of Raymac Crossline, plus my additional question about essentially the scale of acquisition in the southern portion of the Raymac Holdings.
Thank you, sir. Jonathan Bowe for the applicant, and I'm grateful for Ms. Tafour and the rest of the Raymac team and obviously Crossline as well to set out for having set out their position. I should say at the outset that unfortunately Mr. Baker, who was here last time, isn't able to be with us today, and I note obviously the CA date of the CA hearing was changed by a day. So we have Ms. Bencherbain, I think I've pronounced it correctly, from Vattenfall, who will be able to address to a limited extent, I should say, some of the points. And if I could also say that having received the EX2 questions, a technical report is already underway, and I've seen drafts of that. But unfortunately, the person specifically who can respond to those, Mr. Baker, isn't here today. But there are obviously other points which can be addressed today in relation to, as I say, also in outline and on site selection. Also, Mr. Hillis can update in relation to the sort of land acquisition assessment that has been undertaken. And then I will come back at the end to just cover off, sir, your question in particular as to the legal basis for the acquisition. So if I can just ask Ms. Bencherbain just to speak very briefly just to confirm the position in as I say, in very high level terms, because she doesn't have the same technical expertise that Mr. Baker has, to address some of the points which Mr. Thorogood in particular raised.
Yes. Now, just before we go to that, in those circumstances, that obviously re-emphasises the criticality of a fuller rather than a less full set of responses being drawn together for deadline 5, so that then when we're in the final bounce down from deadline 6 onwards, objecting APs have a clear opportunity to participate in that in a way that doesn't disadvantage them in any material sense.
Jonathan Bowe for the applicant, that's fully understood, sir.
Thank you very much. So welcome, and let's now pass through the response to that material.
Delala Bencherbain for the applicant. Yes, so with regard to the GIS versus AIS queries, my understanding is that the GIS provide greater space saving than AIS in the case of a substation which has a single level of voltage. In the case of TANET extension onshore substation, we will need to step up the voltage, so we will have two voltage level. And for this, the design need to account for other electrical equipment, such as transformer, reactive compensation, and harmonic filters. And most of the equipments are located outdoors, and because of those outdoor equipments, this is what are going to be the main drivers for the footprint and the substation layout.
Okay, so to be clear here, your sort of starting point position on this is that you will provide a technical justification for a requirement for an external location and essentially the equivalent of an AIS position for a broad range of equipment other than just the immediate substation itself, and that is necessary on either, whichever way you go, AIS or GIS.
Delilah Bencherbain, yes, we will provide that. Our expert will provide that.
Okay. I mean, do in so doing, have regard to substation design processes for some of the other made orders, because clearly this is a journey that has been travelled already by a considerable number of applicants. And before we kind of accept at face value the proposal that additional space is required here, I certainly think it would assist us to understand, you know, why that space requirement is being set out here in these terms. Is there more detail that you can take us to now?
Delilah Benjamin, unfortunately, I can't provide more details now, but I will take it up with our expert and provide the response.
Okay, that must be by deadline 5, because otherwise there will be essentially natural justice issues that flow from that. Okay, so moving forward.
Thank you, sir. If Mr. Hillis, if we sort of go down the line, perhaps if Mr. Hillis just wanted to update in terms of the land acquisition basis in terms of identifying land required at the site, and we can then go on to perhaps a wider point in terms of Mr. Leake can cover off in terms of the site selection, which Mr. Thorogood also flagged.
Indeed.
Sir John Hillis for the applicant. In terms of the area of land which the applicant is seeking to acquire, this has been defined by the substation design parameters and technical requirements, which defined the amount of land which Vattenfall needed.
Mm. Could we have the works plans up, actually, for that? And it'll be sheet 2 again. And leave the land plan there, because we might toggle backwards and forwards. Now, these are the land plans.
The works plans.
Works plans, yeah. And it's the onshore works plans. There we go. And again, just zoom us in so that we're looking at works number 12, 13, 14, and 15. Thank you.
So the substation land requirement was defined by the substation technical parameters, and they're set out in the onshore project description as being 4.1 hectares of permanent operational land and 2 hectares of temporary construction space, construction compounds. Having identified the substation site and having identified the interests of the Ministry of Justice as the leasehold occupier of that site, we then entered into a process of dialogue with them about how we could best deal with their land interest, bearing in mind its special inalienable nature. And we sought to identify replacement land for the Ministry of Justice Border Force compound. We identified a suitable site also on Ramac property, to the south of our identified substation site, within work number 14. We identified the southern section of that site as being potentially suitable for Border Force's requirements. We then, through a process of dialogue with Border Force and with Ramac, in fact, identified that because the shape of work number 14 is wedge-shaped, is probably the best way of describing it, compared to the rectangular nature of work number 14, that in order to give Border Force an equivalent usable area of land, bearing in mind their main use is parking, heavy goods vehicles and other vehicles, in order to give them that sort of net, you know, equivalent net usable area, we actually needed a larger area in terms of acreage. They currently occupy a 9.93 acre site, and we undertook a transport assessment at the request of the Ministry of Justice to inform a car park design, and that concluded that we required an 11.42 acre site to the south of work number 14. And in order to bring about that relocation of the MOJ interest, we also need to reconfigure the pattern of occupation of the remaining land, of the sort of gap of land in the middle, so to speak.
Yes, I mean, all of those things are understood. I guess the kind of gap in our understanding, though, is why there is a necessity for, and if we switch now back to the land plan again very briefly, for all of that land to be pink land.
Yeah.
Because there are a number of ways of, I guess, resolving that spatial redistribution. And it's by no means 100% clear to us that a compulsory acquisition of the freehold is the only clear way of doing it. In a nutshell, why do you need to end up being essentially the landlord of the Border Force compound, when at the moment another entity is the landlord of the Border Force compound? And is there no reason why an aim of this process could be to essentially leave a kind of restitutio in integrum, to actually put the parties back in broadly the same position as they were before, albeit in a different spatial arrangement?
Jonathan Bauer, for the applicant, it's perhaps useful if I come in at this point, and that's the sort of frame of the question that you've asked in EX2 as well,
yes,
of course.
It is.
The compulsory acquisition regime within the DCO process and more generally doesn't enable the process to achieve the outcome through any other means other than using compulsory acquisition powers at the outset. But what I would say is this, that and your question in EX2 is one which relates to, can temporary possession powers be used as an alternative? In part, yes, it can, to achieve the physical works.
The physical works, indeed.
What it can't do is to provide a mechanism whereby the necessary proprietary arrangements are put in place. So the proposal is from the applicant is as follows, that were compulsory acquisition powers be required to be exercised, then Vattenfall would only seek the freehold of the land it needs for its permanent acquisition, but it needs to exercise compulsory acquisition powers to be able to put in place a proprietary arrangement with the various occupants, including Border Force, Crossline. So what would be the case is that the applicant would exercise those compulsory acquisition powers, offer up a lease on the same terms as existing for those parties who have been displaced, and then offer back the freehold to Ramak, because it can't the compulsory acquisition process doesn't enable a party to acquire a new lease over parcel of land.
I'm very conscious of that, and I'm also turning my mind to previous cases where equivalent justifications for compulsory acquisition have been put forward by applicants, and at this sort of stage in examination, amongst the other positions that have been brought out, is that the applicant is reasonably well progressed in essentially then negotiating an onward position with existing landowners to whom it would grant options to purchase. So in other words, the end state in which compulsory acquisition of the freehold might only persist for months or at the most, you know, a couple of years, is well understood by all parties, and a means of essentially returning that land to an intended end holder of the freehold, subject to new leases, is something that has been evidenced as being capable of being negotiated voluntarily between the parties, albeit with a backstop compulsory acquisition power. Now that certainly happened in a number of previous cases. I guess here it has not yet become sufficiently evident to us that is a road down which this applicant is intending to travel. And I suspect, and I will offer Ramak an opportunity to comment on this, but I suspect that RAMAC are equivalently unsighted as to that end intention. It will be your view that they should be aware that you are proposing to offer them the remaining freehold.
Jonathan Bauer for the applicant. I will pass over to Mr. Hillis in a moment, but I should just stress what I said at the opening on this point, that were compulsory acquisition powers required, the sincere hope from the applicant's side is that given where we are in the status of negotiations, this would become not even an academic point, but a non-point, because agreement would be reached. And if I can pass over to Mr. Hillis, who will just give an update in terms of how the structure of an agreement is being proposed such that no freehold would be required by the applicant.
Thank you very much.
John Hillis for the applicant. We have been progressing, and we're quite well progressed in negotiations with RAMAC for an option agreement that will hopefully grant the applicant the rights that they need to install their cables and build their substation, and that option will give the applicant the right to take up a lease for their substation site, an easement for their incoming cable circuits, and it also includes a tripartite arrangement with the Ministry of Justice, which deals with the financial and practical implications of moving them from the applicant's proposed substation site to the proposed area of replacement land. And we're grateful to RAMAC for their constructive approach to those negotiations. The applicant is hopeful that we can progress to finalise contracts during May. That's a reasonable objective. So we're not proposing in our negotiations, we're not proposing the buy the freehold and sell it back scenario, but we are quite well progressed with an alternative scenario.
Okay. Well, if it's not the buy it and sell it back scenario, so just give me a little more detail about what the scenario actually consists of.
The scenario is a lease of the applicant substation site, a shorter lease of land that they require for a temporary construction compound, an easement for the incoming cable circuits through the Bay Point Club land and the BCA land, and an agreement amongst the three parties, RAMAC, the Ministry of Justice, and the applicant about how the relocation of the MOJ can be brought about.
Okay, so that would actually leave all of this pink land essentially unacquired by yourselves?
In terms of the freehold, yeah.
Okay. Can I just draw RAMAC? By the way, my rounded vowels, is it RAMAC or RAMAC?
Isabella Tafour for the applicant. I'll just turn behind me. But I've been saying RAMAC, and I think that's because I've heard members of my team saying it so. So RAMAC.
RAMAC. Okay. This is like ALARP and ALARP. And I'm afraid I spent too long in the colonies, and so you will forever be RAMAC. Okay. Can you just give me a response briefly to that proposition that actually there are some substantial negotiations going on here that might leave RAMAC as the freeholder?
Sir David Haynes, Chancellor Speechleys for RAMAC. Yes, indeed, there has been negotiations. They are ongoing. As we sit here today, our understanding is that, in fact, the heads of terms for the agreement between RAMAC, Vattenfall and the Ministry of Justice are not yet agreed. And the concern from RAMAC is that, despite the fact we're now some significant way into the DCO process, we're now on the 18th of April. The indication given is that contracts may be sorted in May. Clearly, that is a concern. that we are where we are, but the negotiations, certainly from our part, are not as far forward as we would like.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think there's much. There is now a light shining in what was otherwise a fairly obscure corner. On that basis, I will return to the applicant and ask if anything else needs to be drawn out in order to respond to both Crossline and RAMAC before we draw this element of the hearing to a close.
Jonathan Bauer for the applicant. Before I pass to Mr. Leake, there's just one point of observation, actually, in relation to Crossline, and just in terms of their lease. Just to put on record that, having reviewed the lease, it's an excluded lease from the protection of security of tenure in the 1954 Act. That's the only point of observation I wanted to make. But Mr. Hillis has already updated in terms of, he's yet to update in terms of Crossline.
Okay.
Shall we do Mr. Hillis now and then go on to Mr. Leake?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir. John Hillis for the applicant. We do have a plan for how we could reconfigure the Crossline lease area in the scenario that the arrangements which the applicant are negotiating with RAMAC conclude as we think they will. Those are discussions that we would propose to take forward with both RAMAC and with Crossline over the coming period. But we're confident that we can ensure a good level of business continuity to Crossline. I would also just pick up on the comment that heads of terms aren't agreed. I think there's a good level of agreement around a large majority of the items that are listed in quite a lengthy set of heads of terms. I think that one of the issues that we have is that because we're negotiating an agreement amongst three parties, in essence, there does tend to be that communication loop that needs to be closed out. As you often will agree an item with one party, and the third party may have a slightly different view on life. And I think probably worth picking up on the fact that we do also have draft contracts that are issued, and which RAMAC have helpfully commented on and provided feedback on to allow us to adjust them further and work towards an agreement.
Okay, and now.
Jonathan Bauer, the applicant, if I can just pass to Mr. Leake, who will cover briefly just some of the points that were raised in relation to site selection from an environmental perspective.
Thank you very much. Mr. Leake.
Sean Leake on behalf of the applicant. I suppose primarily just to respond to Mr. Thorogood's observations with regards to the study area, I will refer back to the site selection chapter. And because I'm also Sammy, I can be in charge of driving the screen. So if I just pulled up sort of page 43 as a PDF of the site selection chapter, and apologies that this doesn't read sort of transparently, I suppose, in the observations of Mr. Four. In terms of the qualitative process that goes on, alongside all of the other material outputs and presentation of study areas. But it is, of course, part of the process that a wider study area will be considered initially. The process that you can see that's outlined here in paragraph 4.10.10 is that the appraisal of the onshore cable routes, noting that this is specifically with regards to the cable routes, obviously, was undertaken following an initial engineering workshop conducted prior to the substation relocation. So there were these engineering workshops that were undertaken, looking at the search areas. And 1 kilometre, as I say, is the study area that's made its way through into the chapter for detailed consideration by what other parties. The reality, as I say, is that these things are presented in a workshop. They're shown on a screen. And apologies, I'm just going to drive through a few pages of the site selection just to illustrate through reference to the designated sites figure in particular. That just, I think, helps illustrate that, I shall scroll down a little further, that there is this 1 kilometre study area that was one kilometre buffer around the Richborough Energy Park, the cable routes, and the study area considers all of these designated sites out with that as well. We don't kind of arbitrarily just cut it off at the 1 kilometre during these workshops. You consider them in the round, if I can use that term. I'm going to keep it relatively brief just through reference to these designated sites, but the same is true when you then start to look through some of the other kind of environmental constraints, whether that might be flood risk or archaeology and other factors, all of which, again, bears in mind the scoping responses that are received. And we try then to present this sort of complex process as transparently as possible, generally in a linear manner in these chapters, but it is inherently more complex than that. So I just wanted to really contextualise the study area that, of course, we present 1 kilometre within the chapter, but inherent within the process is that you consider constraints that may overlap into a broader area.
Okay. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Leake. I mean, that's actually kind of, again, shone a light into what was previously a slightly obscure corner. Are there other points that you wish to bring out in your response before I just finally return to both Romac and Crossline for a brief reply on their positions?
Jonathan Bow for the applicant. Nothing specific other than to just emphasise that the technical response will be provided by deadline 5 at the absolute latest, taking into account and having heard loud and clear your comments, sir. In addition to the work that's already been undertaken as part of the preparation in response to the EX2 questions, points which have been raised by Ramac will also be dealt with as part of that.
Yes. Now, if when we're looking at what is likely to emerge at deadline 5, are we going to be in a position also to have a position where there is greater clarity on the progress in relation to negotiations with Ramac around this delivery approach that would essentially leave them as freeholder of the land? Because I guess at some point they need to know whether they're kind of coming off the fence and making final written submissions to this examining authority that they believe that they are still subject to broad-scale compulsory acquisition of a freehold, or alternatively, they're sufficiently progressed that their comfort levels have now risen to a point where maybe the way in which they frame their objection has changed. Because if we could reach that position as a consequence of something that you put to them by deadline 5, so that by deadline 6, which is the bounce down, they can then come back into the public process and actually set out either we're broadly content, subject to these reservations, or alternatively, we sustain our in-principle objection for these reasons, that would be very helpful to us. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that you need to kind of play your poker hand in public in negotiation with Ramac at deadline 5, but in timing terms, sometime in or around that time space, I think you need to get yourselves into a position where you have communicated sufficiently with Ramac so that at deadline 6, Ramac can either call this that they're on one side of the process where they're continuing to object, or on another side of the process where they believe that they're moving to settlement. Does that sound reasonably fair?
John Hillis for the applicant. Sorry, yes, that does sound like a good arrangement.
Excellent. So you don't have an obligation on this at deadline 5, but you do have to have done something privately sufficient so that Ramac can return to the public domain at deadline 6. Good. If that's then an action, it's rather complicated. But I'm afraid I couldn't think of a way of making it any simpler than that. What I'm now going to do is I'm just going to go briefly to Crossline Limited and ask whether, in the light of what you've heard from the applicant, there is anything further you want to say before your hearing is brought to an end.
Magdalena Gapka-Skaffins for Crossline Limited. I don't think we have anything further to add at this point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then finally to Raymac and ask the same question.
Isabella Tafour for Raymac. Just very briefly, so I think it's 3 points that I want to make. First relates to the point that you just touched upon and the potential for an agreement between Raymac and the applicant. Now, so I understand that your position at the preliminary meeting was that you weren't interested, particularly in hearing about progress with negotiations until concluded agreements were reached. Mm. Our position, and I'm happy to play our poker hand out in public, is that unless and until an agreement is reached and signed, we will be maintaining our objection. And so I've heard what the applicant says about progress of negotiations. Certainly we had hoped that we wouldn't have to attend the previous hearing in February. Following that hearing, we were very hopeful that we wouldn't have to attend today. But here we are again. And so if we are to withdraw our objection, that would only be on the basis that an agreement had been reached in good time before deadline six, to enable us to be satisfied that our concerns have been addressed. So that's the first point. The second is that I would just ask you, you'll remember, sir, in February we looked at the consideration of alternatives in the environmental statement, and we looked at the treatment in particular of the onshore substation, the consideration of which only came into play at stage five of the six stages of project analysis set out. And I'll just ask you to go back to, in due course, the section on the onshore substation, which begins on page 439, and the cable routing, which follows. We don't say that the assessment that's carried out there is adequate. And the third and final point I'd like to make is to express our disappointment that the applicant hasn't come today with its technical experts able to address the issue on land taken GIS, AIS. That's a point we've been making since January 2018 in our pre-application consultation response. We've made it in all our consultation responses since then. We made the point at the hearing in February. And we've gone to the trouble and expense of having our technical experts here to deal with that issue, and just to note that we're disappointed that the applicant hasn't done the same.
Well, I note that disappointment, and of fairness in the process, I will give you the same guidance as I have given to others in the process, which is that there is, in the guidance suite on national infrastructure examination, which you can access readily from the Planning Inspectorate's own website, guidance from what was then the Department for Communities and Local Government. It's still called the DCLG guidance because following their rebranding, they haven't issued any further guidance. So if you look there, you will find guidance on both compulsory acquisition and indeed guidance on the costs process, and you know, it's entirely up to you to review and make what you will of those of the advice in those guidance notes. Only to note that the formal requirement is that if you are submitting an application for costs, it must be made within 28 days of the closure of the examination stage. So it can be made after examination, but 28 days is the time that you are put to make an application. It doesn't have to be made oral. Okay. Are there then any other items that we need to deal with in brief before we move on to the remaining items of the agenda. Now, in relation, ladies and gentlemen, to the remaining agenda items, agenda item 3 was placed here as essentially the reading of the bans. This is statutory undertaker and other special provisions objections. We've heard from the National Trust, who was one of those. None of the others have requested to be heard, and I am then content that the remainder of that material just proceed in writing, and we will review whether there's anything further we need to ask at EXQ3. There is also the process at agenda item 4, which is a review of individual sites with no objections. Now, that most of that is just essentially a desktop process for the examining authority. There are some questions, however, in relation to the Richborough Energy Park site, and I'll return to those in a second. But just looking at the remainder of the agenda, we've dealt with monitoring of negotiations and progress in relation to the affected parties who are here present today. And so what I'm now proposing to do is just to deal with the remaining balance of my few questions on agenda item 4 and a brief opportunity for the applicant to update us on agenda item 5. It'd be perfectly at liberty for any of the other attendees to depart if you wish to, but equivalently you're perfectly at liberty to remain. Moving then on to agenda item 4, can we just return to the land plan, please, which is one of the tabs, and then if we could just drag the screen across so that we can actually see Richborough Energy Park and the green notations. Now, essentially here, we're returning to the position that we were in following the last compulsory acquisition hearing. There's a sustained optionality here. That was clearly explained to us, and the basis for it is clearly explained in the document set. We have also visited it. We know what the three green corridors and passing through that site consist of, and we've also asked some written questions in EXQ2. I just would, however, like to ask the applicant if there is any update in terms of progress towards settling out whether any one of those three options is becoming preferred, because, as they will be well aware, at the end of the day, as soon as a preference starts to become evident, then there is an underlying assumption that preference would then be focused on in the process, and that compulsory acquisition powers should not normally be granted over optionality where there has been a clarification that an option is no longer quite as necessary as it once was.
Jonathan Bauer for the applicant, and there is no further update in terms of progress such that all of the options still remain on the table. The question that's been raised in EX2 in relation to the examining authorities wish to understand how it could be, if I sort of term it, controlled, such that the powers are only exercised over the land that is actually required, is fully understood, and a mechanism is being prepared to enable that to be dealt with within the draft DCO, because it's the applicant's desire that they would only ever exercise powers over land that it needs for the scheme, not all three options.
And indeed, that as soon as that becomes apparent, that the blighting effect of maintaining powers over the other corridors would fall away.
Jonathan Bauer for the applicant, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Understood. Well, look, we can probably park that then and await your written answer. That was the only kind of high-level matter that I wanted to flag in a public hearing. The rest can proceed in writing, subject to me testing with my colleagues, see if there's anything else. No. Okay. Negotiations and progress. Can the applicant tell us any more about ongoing conversations with affected persons. Essentially here, for us to get a sense of whether what we now see is what we will report on and take to the Secretary of State, or whether there is likely at any of the following deadlines to be a further update that might significantly change the position. Again, I urge on the applicant the need to make sure that, if it is at all humanly possible, we do not go beyond deadline six without standing needs to flex elements of the CATP and related powers requests, because if you do, you will be removing from people their effective opportunity to participate in this examination, and that is in principle not a good place to be in. So I do note that a number of the negotiations here have been taking quite a lot of time, and I just wanted not to finish this hearing without sending out a very clear signal that that time is now distinctly finite.
So, John Hillis, for the applicant, we absolutely take on board that point, and we're working to conclude voluntary agreements with as many parties as we possibly can. And I note the comments about deadline six, but I think the applicant's intent would be to continue to pursue agreements, for as long as is possible, and to exercise any rights of compulsory acquisition that they may be granted to the minimum possible extent, and to that end, we are seeking to negotiate with all parties along the route.
Yeah, I mean, prioritising your positions, though, the thing that you clearly, I'm sure, are aware of, but you need to have absolutely at the top of your mind, is that what you don't want to do, I mean, yes, you obviously need to continue to pursue negotiations, I'm sure, beyond deadline six, but if you have choices in terms of the people that you're devoting those negotiating resources to, between people who are essentially quite close to you and where you think there is a settlement in prospect, that they're perhaps not quite such a good use of your time as people with whom you might have distinctly more substantial outstanding concerns, who, if you were to leave them beyond deadline six, you might be running a risk of them wanting to approach the examination with a live issue. So there's a little bit of a triage exercise that's probably worth doing at this stage.
Sir, John Hillis, for the applicant, I agree with your comments. Is it worth, or would it be a benefit to run through the various ownerships?
It would, in the circumstances. I think if you can just very briefly take us through where you think you are, and just run along the essentially the line of the ownerships, and if you could just flag whether there are any that are likely, in your view, to be more complex or difficult.
That'd be it. If you could put the
which one?
If you just put the onshore land plans.
Yep.
The land plans.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, we might tip across into the book of reference, so it might be worth having another tab with the BOR available just in case. Probably best to start at the sea and.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we start at the foreshore with the first land parcel, which is in the ownership of Thanet District Council, I think we may need a plan that goes all the way to low water, if possible. Just onto the next sheet.
Yeah, that's the one.
So that first land parcel, 01, is in the ownership of Thanet District Council, to whom we've made an offer of an option to grant an easement, and we're in discussions with them at the minute. Progress has been slightly less swift than the applicant may have preferred, due to ill health in the Thanet District Council Estates team, but we now have a new contact. We're progressing that towards an agreement, and certainly anticipate at least heads of terms being agreed by deadline six. Moving then inshore, We move into the National Trust portion of the freehold, and we've heard from them today, and clearly that's a focus in terms of the triage exercise for us over the next the coming weeks. We then move onshore into land which is owned by Kent County Council, and we have reached a commercial agreement with them this week, and we're in the final stages of agreeing heads of terms. It's worth noting as well that for both of those areas of land, Kent Wildlife Trust are an occupier.
Yep.
Of both the National Trust portion of the foreshore and the majority of the Kent County Council ownership within Pegwell Bay Country Park. And our discussions with the National Trust, we are seeking to include a consent from Kent Wildlife Trust as the occupier to that transaction. Moving on from the Kent County Council freehold land, we move into Stoneleys Nature Reserve, parcel 075 there. Kent Wildlife Trust have an objection to the scheme and particularly to the routing site selection issues. We had been in discussions with them, and we're continuing to try and pursue voluntary agreements. But I would say of all of the land ownerships along the route, this is probably the one where we're furthest behind in terms of voluntary discussions. I think that, as I mentioned, we are speaking to them about consenting to a number of other transactions where they are a leaseholder in somebody else's freehold property, and we continue to try and persuade them that a voluntary agreement in terms of their own freehold land parcel would be of benefit. From Stoneleys Nature Reserve, we go into land which is owned by Ramac, which we've covered off.
It's
worth noting that British Car Auctions are an occupier there, where we are seeking to agree enter into a compensation agreement with them, which will address any limitations on their use of the property during the construction phase of the project. We would anticipate that to conclude by deadline 6. We've also covered the position in relation to the Secretary of State in the form of the Ministry of Justice, and we've also covered the position in relation to Crossline. It's worth noting that there is another short-term occupier within the Ramac, the wider Ramac ownership, in the form of P&G Scaffolding and Philip Griffiths, and we will. We have given thought to how we can accommodate all of the occupiers within the Ramac ownership in terms of putting together that puzzle of different occupiers. We then go from the substation site under the road into Richborough Energy Park, where we are also pursuing an option agreement, and we are seeking to option all of the land which is within the order limits. The focus of discussions there at the minute are on how long we may need to hold that option for, and similar to discussions we've been having in here today about the process that will be gone through when the decision is actually made on which route option to choose, or which is the best option at the end of the day. I think that it's fair to say that the particular concerns of that landowner are about how will their use of the property be restricted, essentially during the option period. and we're seeking to address those concerns. It's worth noting that they changed agents at the end of March, so we've had a process of bringing their new agents up to speed with the proposals, and we have a meeting with them next week. The final ownership, which I was going to touch on, was National Grid Electricity Transmission.
Yes.
As we do need to install cables within their leasehold, they have a leasehold of land from Richborough A Limited, the owners of the energy park. There is a connection agreement in place between the parties, and it sets out the terms of how the project will connect. And the applicant essentially is relying on the terms of the connection agreement to govern kind of ownership and the arrangements for cable laying within the substation.
And that raises probably the one final point that's scratching the back of our skulls at the moment, which is that, you know, NGET are an interested party. They are also an affected person. They are also a statutory undertaker. And we therefore have to have regard to the standing of their objection and be very clear that we're reporting to the Secretary of State on the basis of it either being a sustained objection or alternatively a withdrawn one. So again, we'd be very grateful for your attention to their particular position in the bounce down. Now, one final matter that I was going to cover with you was the fact that when we issued our EXQ1, we included a sort of monitoring table process that I'm sure you're familiar with, and we're grateful for the content of that process at the subsequent deadlines, where you've basically dealt with particularly the statutory undertaker and special land provisions and the various tables that you produce in relation to those questions. Those questions remain live, but I'm conscious that following our kind of pirouette on timetable to address other matters that have arisen, the deadlines on those questions have now fallen a little out of sync, because they ask you to bring everything down to final conclusion at deadline 7 rather than at deadline 8. And so what I was just going to foreshadow was that we will review essentially the common sense around that timing and see if we need at all to change the deadlines at which those tables are produced, because what we need essentially by the end of the examination is a latest position on particularly anybody who is a statutory undertaker or benefits from any of the special land-related provisions under the 2008 Act. So it's in turn where the Secretary of State has special formal determinations to make, we can ask the Secretary of State to make those determinations. Yes, we will review the timescales for those questions, and if we need to change the bounce down that's indicated in EXQ1, we will find a method in the not too distant future of doing that. However, at the moment, what is your view? Because if you can continue to deliver that with an end point at deadline 7 rather than needing the extra time to deadline 8, that might be the simplest thing to do, just to leave it as it is. And I just thought I'd give you the opportunity to come back to me on that point.
Sir, I think we would be comfortable with it being left as it is, and we'll continue to provide updates.
Fine.
You know, at each deadline where there are updates to provide.
In which case, that's simple. Let's not confuse things any further. Let's leave that EXQ1 bounce down process on the original deadlines. Okay. Now, I will just return back to agenda. And on that basis, I believe we have concluded items 4 and 5. In terms of agenda item 6, an action list has been maintained. I don't propose to bore you by running through it line item by line item now. I think most people should be pretty clear where individual actions bore on them. We will aim to publish that, but bear with us, given the forthcoming Easter break, it may be early next week, because at the moment the focus of our efforts and prioritisation are actually on documenting actions from the preceding hearing, issue-specific hearing number 8. Next steps, agenda item number 7, only to be very clear about the criticality of the bounce-down process from deadline 6 through 7 to 8, because there will be no more oral hearings on compulsory acquisition-related matters. And so, ladies and gentlemen, unless there's anything else that people wish to say before I close this last compulsory acquisition hearing in this examination, I therefore propose to close the hearing and all other matters will be dealt with in writing. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We will resume in this room wearing different hats for issue-specific hearing number 9 at 2 p.m.